Welcome back to the Jewish Futurism Lab, where we unpack Torah, tech, and tomorrow. I'm Mike Wirth, Jewish futurist, community artist, and design educator, coming to you from Crowntown, Charlotte, North Carolina. Today, I want to introduce you to Professor Shai Davidai. He's an Israeli-born social psychologist and former Columbia Business School professor who became known around the world for standing up publicly for his Jewish students after October 7th. This is the episode where we put Shai's story, his scholarship, and his activism on the table and ask what they might teach us about the Jewish future. Let's get into it, y'all. I first encountered Shai, like most of you, on TV and online in the days just after October 7th. He was this strong-voiced guy standing outside the gates of Columbia University, and he spoke with such clear conviction and a sharp understanding of what was actually unfolding around him at his university and with his students. Now, he's no longer at Columbia University, and he's a podcast host with the show Here I Am. Shai is a dad and a strong Jewish voice, and I was delighted when he wanted to talk about being professors, parents, and Jews, and about the future. Here's my interview with Shai Davidai. So friends, we are here today with an incredible individual, Shai Davidai, originally from Israel, and now you live in New York, right?
New York City, yes.
New York City. For now. Fantastic. Shai, we're lucky to have you here today. And we want to start off with just some basics before we get into some, you know, hot topics. But can you share a little bit of your background and really your Jewish story with us?
Man, whenever people ask that question, they say, oh, we'll just start off with something simple. Tell me your background, Jewish history, Jewish story, Jewish genealogy. Look, I was born and raised in Israel. When the one thing that's extremely beautiful but also weird about growing up in Israel is that you don't need to think about your Jewish identity. I tell people it's in the water. You know, you just dip your toe and you are Jewish. To an extent that even the 20% non-Jews in the country have a lot of Jewish education and history because, you know, you live in this country. I tell people it's the only country that doesn't suffer from anti-Semitism, suffers from a lot of other stuff. But, you know, my typical Ashkenazi Jewish story, my maternal grandparents came from Romania after realizing that there was no real future for Jews in the Eastern Bloc. This is in the 1950s. My paternal grandmother was brought as a very young girl to Jerusalem in 1935 by her Zionist, my great-grandfather, her Zionist father. And my paternal grandfather was actually born in British Mandate Palestine. But his father also, you know, they came to the Ottoman Empire out of pure Zionism. We weren't religious at home. We weren't observant at home, but every Friday night we would do the Kiddush. Partially because I'd say my grandfather was an atheist, but my grandmother was a believer. And he cared more about, you know, his wife and his love than his atheism, which I think is important. And so we grew up doing Kiddush. I have family that's become more religious. I have family that's anti-religious, and I'm somewhere in the middle.
Fabulous. You found your way to the United States and started to study social psychology at the New School.
Well, I studied I worked at the New School as a professor. I studied at Cornell. Yeah, my wife and I, she was my girlfriend at the time. We wanted the American experience, the higher education experience of the United States, which I was infatuated with, and. You know, we were 27 at the time. This is almost 16 years ago. We were untethered, and let's go to the U.S. and see what happens. And I got my PhD in social psychology. My wife got a master's in creative writing.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And then you made your way before arriving at Columbia, then to New School as a faculty member. Okay.
Yeah. Faculty member for 3 years at the New School. Very interesting place, I must say.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah. I was a student there at Parsons and then also taught from 01 to 03. Definitely a different time then, for sure. But then, you know, you made your way to Columbia. And how'd that feel? Like, how'd that feel first going to Columbia and kind of getting into that ecosystem there?
So I must be honest, it was the best thing in the world. It was my dream job. And so the history of that is around 2018, I was teaching at the New School. I was, you know, I was satisfied, but not super satisfied. I felt like there might be other things out there for me. I was thinking about, you know, moving back to Israel with my wife, and then we had just one kid. But we put the brake on that, and we said, you know what, let me first see if there's another job in New York City so we don't have to uproot our entire lives. There were two jobs listed that year, 2018 when I was applying. And one was at NYU, one is at Columbia. And I knew both were long shots, but you know what, you missed 100% of the shots you don't take, right? So I applied to both. NYU never even responded, never replied to my messages. So who knows, maybe they're still considering. I don't know what happened there, but Columbia, I was surprised. They offered me an interview. So I showed up to the interview, again, not really expecting much. And then I got the job and I was super excited. This was my, as an academic, it's a dream job. You know, it's in one of the best cities in the world with one of the best funding, with the best minds, best students. It was really like where I hoped I would get tenure and stay for the rest of my life.
I could see that, man. That must have felt amazing. Talk about, you know, kind of as the honeymoon there started to die down, and you know, did you see or notice any sort of things on campus starting to percolate before October 7th, or did it just hit?
Yeah, the truth is, I did not. In retrospect, you know, having like now the hindsight, you know, 2020, and looking at everything and connecting the different dots, I can definitely see that this was percolating. This was, you know, coming. But as I was living it, the honeymoon didn't die out. It really just one day just stopped. Like I was, you know, every job has its ups and downs, but I never even thought that me being Jewish or Israeli had, you know, had any bearing on how my work was going. But then, you know, then October 7th, 2023 happens. Then I say October 8, 2023, which the moment the war started in the diaspora. And since then, I, you know, within days, I realized this is not the place that I thought it is.
That must have been like a sinking feeling, you know, having your dream become a nightmare kind of overnight.
Yeah, you know, it was more of shock, surprise. A lot of this thing, which since then a lot of Jewish people have described in their own different fields, is like this feeling of self-doubt. Maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I'm the one who's wrong. Maybe, you know, maybe like my interpretations are off the mark. But then I realized, no, this is just gaslighting. Like, what's happening in the university, my university, other people in their universities or in their companies or whatever they are, you know, what's happening is just unacceptable. But so before there was the sadness and the frustration and the grief and all the, you know, million stages of coping with anti-Semitism, there was just like this, I can't believe this is happening. This isn't supposed to happen.
Yeah, I can concur. I definitely know exactly what you mean. Talk about that. Idea of the self-isolation, right? Really feel like everybody around me screaming. And when usually when people do that, I'm probably doing something wrong. But in this case, I'm sure like you, I couldn't find anything that I was doing wrong in that moment that would have merited any of the responses that, you know, not only that you were hearing and seeing, but, you know, in my little tiny college, we didn't have protests like y'all did up in Columbia. But there's still chatter amongst the faculty, you know, there's still conversations and things that, you know, that people had around. And you didn't know me at the time, but I had sent you a DM on Instagram, like October 12th or 13th, I think, I forget when you started to show yourself on TV, or at least they started showing you. And I had asked you, I said, hey, I'm at this small little college, you know, working with Jewish life in the South, you know, what kind of recommendations, what would you offer us, you know, out in the field as a way to handle or to deal with these things? You know, I kind of realized as I was typing that to you, you probably didn't know in that moment, you were living it, right? And it was unfolding and unpacking right before that. But we've had some time since then. So, you know, you've moved on from academia, I believe. What do you have for the rest of us? Like, how can we kind of carry on with some wisdom?
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't know if I can live up to wisdom. I'm still waiting to get older so I can be wiser. But I would say, for me, you know, like I said, looking back, I realized that there were a lot of warning signs. Some of them I just didn't notice, or, you know, weren't, the alarm wasn't going, you know, loud enough, but some of them I was aware of and I minimized or brushed away, or this is a fringe idea, this is a fringe student group, this is a fringe faculty, you know, because honestly, because I didn't want to believe, because it was very easy for me being an academic, you know, it's Cornell, at the New School, at Columbia Business School, like all those places, it was very easy for me to be an academic and says, oh, I can clearly see the anti-Semitism of the extreme right. And you got to remember, like, this is the time of Tree of Life shooting, the Chabad Palmway shooting. It was very clear, like, the extreme right, yes, there's anti-Semitism. But it was much harder for me to accept the fact that there's hate, there's anti-Semitism, not just in the extreme left, but also inside the institutions where I call home. And when that happens, like for a lot of us, the cognitive dissonance kicks in. And I was just brushing things away. I remember reading Deborah Lipstadt's book about anti-Semitism and nodding along the entire book. And then the moment it starts talking about academia, I started, like, instead of nodding, I started like going like no with my head, like this isn't right. So I wasn't ready to accept the reality. So the moment things started and you know, my eyes were like really wide open to see all the things were happening at Columbia and at Harvard other campuses, I decided, this was a conscious choice, that not only will I never not see this, but also I will make sure that everyone else sees this. So now it's my responsibility to make sure that other people, especially other people who, like me, are motivated not to see it, will see it. So when I travel around the country and I speak with different communities and groups and organizations and students and faculty, I tell them, like, I can't come to your campus or your group or your organization and tell you what's wrong, because I don't live that. You only know what's wrong, and you only know what the right response is or should be. But what I can tell you is the same, you know, the same goal that I set for myself. Like, if you don't make sure that everyone sees this, they just won't see it. So for some people, that means making clear that they see it in the classrooms, if it's students raising their hands and challenging their professors. For some, it's in the outside on campus, you know, with student organizations, with groups, with community activities. For some, it's visually, just making stickers, posters, infographics. For some, it's going to city council and testifying in front of city council, writing letters to op-eds, whatever it is, like, you know, whatever you can do to raise the awareness to say, like, this is, we know this is happening, and we need to make sure that every Jew, and obviously every non-Jew, also realizes that it's happening. I guess that's my advice. I don't know, you know, sometimes people want more concrete, like, tell me what to do now. Where should I aim? When should I shoot? And I'm like, that's up to you. Mine is more of the brand of, let's start getting everyone moving, and then things will be better.
And, you know, I'm curious, like, as we look forward to move and to act and, you know, try to march somewhat in unity and harmony, you know, are there things out there that you've seen, like forms of Jewish identity or activities, behaviors, or communities that, like, feel like prototypes for something new that could work? You know, we've seen a lot of things in reaction to October 7th and in reaction to a lot of the hate and the things that are out there. But anything proactive that you've seen that you feel inspired by?
Yeah, definitely. But I would say that the unit of analysis in Jewish life, Jewish history, is not the individual, but the community. And I would, and the future of the Jewish people, I believe, lies in community, not in Jewish individuals. And what I've found powerful, both internally and also externally, is Jewish communities, Jewish events, Jewish organizations that run the gamut of Jewish identities. What I mean is, when I go and I'm at an event where, you know, people can't see me, but, you know, I'm all tattooed up, I identify as an atheist Jew, but where I'm standing next to a Reform rabbi, a conservative rabbi, and an Orthodox rabbi, and we got people with black hats and beards, we got people that are completely, like, gender queer, whatever it is, you know, all the different kind of Jews, but we're all standing together. We're sending a message to ourselves that, you know, the community is more important than our differences, than each individual. But also, we're sending a message to the world, because then the world sees us from the outside and they can't divide and conquer, right? One of the things that are happening is, in New York City, anti-Jewish hate crimes have been the highest hate crime of all different groups for 9 years straight. The vast majority of the victims of that do not look like me. They are Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox yeshiva boys from Brooklyn. But when we stand together and we say, look, from the outside, it might look like we're different, but from the inside, we're actually all the same, despite our, you know, lifestyle differences. I think that gives us a lot of power. And that at the end will be the source of how we beat this. For too long in Jewish history, we've been fighting on who is right. You know, is it the Reform? Is it conservative? Is it Orthodox? Is it Hasidic Jews? Is it what, like Kabbalah? Like, and saying, like, no, we're all right. We need all of the different types in order to move forward.
I totally agree. I think, you know, power and community is amazing. And I think, you know, do you agree that, like, we need to still have a blend of legacy institutions? You know, like, these universities have shown that they can't behave well. Do you think that it's time to say goodbye to them? Or do you think that there's a role for them mixed in with Jewish organizations, even looser organizations, you know, podcasts like we're talking about? I guess my question is, do you see that should we go out on our own, or should we still stick with, you know, Columbia's, Harvard's, Cornell's, and other places? You know, do you think that they can be better?
I definitely think they could be better. I don't like wasting my time. And if I thought that they couldn't be better, they couldn't be improved, I wouldn't wage this fight. I wouldn't, you know, I have better things to do with my time than, you know, than bump my head against a wall again and again and again. Mm-hmm. So I definitely think these places can and should be better, not just for Jews, but for everybody. But also with this fight that I've been waging for the past 2.5 years, I've realized how bad things are. And when I say bad, it's not necessarily that every day, you know, every Jew feels excluded, like not at all, but how bad in the sense that how institutionalized, how part of the system, this denigrating perception of Jews and Israelis is in these universities. But if we couldn't save them, then I would just say let's leave them. But I don't think we need to leave them, not yet. I also think that Jews had such a outsized contribution to the academic system in the United States, and leaving them now or fleeing them is exactly what, you know, the establishment would want us to do, right? We come, we build, and then we leave. We did that in the, you know, in the story of Egypt. We built the pyramids and then we leave. Now, from Egypt, we had to flee because we were enslaved. I don't think we're there yet at Columbia and Harvard. I think we can keep fighting and making sure that we reap the fruits of the, you know, that our ancestors have planted there.
So one thing we do on the show here is we're always looking at, you know, what is this intersection between the Torah, right? Not as necessarily a religious document, but a cultural one, technology, and then the tomorrow, right? And you and I, we live in this kind of fault line between social media, mass media, and these old anti-Semitic narratives. You know, they all collide. So if we were to look ahead here for a second, what have you seen, or maybe you're dreaming about, like tools, narrative strategies, do you think that Jewish people will need to stop just playing defense and start offering stories, right, that other people tell about us? You know, where do you think we're heading with that? Wow. Small question.
Look, the only reason that you and I and the 15.8 million Jews exist in the world is because our ancestors made some decisions that increased the chances of Jewish continuity, right? And some of those decisions were are still controversial, and I don't like to get into them, like intermarriage and stuff like that. But some of those decisions are just technological, right? They invented the synagogue, the Bet Knesset, right? And I say, and you know, and I say it in Hebrew because the word for synagogue, Bet Knesset, means house of congregation, not house of prayer, not house of worship, but house of congregation, right? That was a technological advancement that did not exist in the world back then, but basically said, you're stateless, but you're still a nation, you have places to congregate. So unlike all the other people, the nations, like the Moabites, the Canaanites of the ancient past, you know, who didn't have that congregational technology, and I say technology with air quotes, we did. So we congregated and we kept going. We came up with things like the bar and bar mitzvahs later, but the bar mitzvahs, right? The idea of how do we incorporate the next generation into our community so that they keep that going. We started saying our prayers in, you know, sing-songy styles, and every group, Ashkenazi, Sephardic, Mizrahi, has their own tunes in order to make it easier for people to memorize, right? It's much easier to remember the lyrics of a song than just the words printed out without the song. So these are technological advances. We don't think of them as such, but they were at the time, that increased the chances that the next generation will stay Jewish. And what I think we should do is, one, keep those technological advances from the past because they've been proven to succeed, and see what can we come up with that builds on the same ideas. The idea of community, of memory, of portability, of moving from one generation to the next. And if we're able to really take those ideas, both from the past and then new ones, and synthesize them, I think we will be able to really increase the chances of Jewish continuity. And that's the goal. The goal is not to fight anti-Semitism. I mean, of course, we don't want anti-Semitism, but the goal is to make sure that the Jewish story doesn't end with us. So for me, those are the most important things we can do.
Wonderful. Great, great words to live by. And you seem to be having an excellent experience unpacking so much of this on your new podcast. I don't know how new it is anymore. But Here I Am, Hineni, mm-hmm. You know, the blueprints that you're putting down, the theories, the rules, the kind of the filters that you're building to pass people's ideas through, you know, if that were to become some kind of blueprint in the future, you know, what do you think from what you've learned so far that we should be doing differently? I know you've touched on it a little bit, but you know, my question really is, like you ask a lot of people, is how do you know, with your efforts to keep this Jewish continuity going, how do you know that it's a success?
Right. That's the biggest problem. And I think you've really identified the big problem is you do not know. Right. It's the same, like you're planting trees to, you know, to fight deforestation. How do you know you're a success? The truth is you're going on faith, not religious faith, but just faith that, you know, the future will bear fruit for what you're, you know, what you're putting now into the soil. And I understand that a lot of people, when they don't have that certainty, they don't have that assurance that things will work, they turn to God or any other metaphysical belief. I don't have that. It's just not something that my brain is wired to do. So for me, it's just the faith in the Jewish people. I feel very strongly that if we all spent 10% of our time worrying about Jewish continuity, then we won't have to worry about Jewish continuity. The problem is that when most of us take Jewish continuity for granted and don't worry about it, we actually create the reason that people like myself worry, because our ancestors did not take things for granted. They did not take their Jewish identity. They did not take the belief that things will continue for the Jewish people, or that the Jewish people will continue for granted. They fought for it, or they, with their lives, with, you know, with their resistance, with their survival. The moment we started taking it for granted is the moment we started endangering that. So I don't know if we will succeed, but I do know one thing. If we don't do anything, then we will fail.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Gosh, that's pretty dire.
I tell people I don't know what the opposite of inspiration, but I'm not an inspirational speaker. I might inspire people to do things, but you don't listen to me and then say, you know what, that's a great TED talk, I feel great about myself. You know, this is the truth. The truth is that, you know, we're living in an unprecedentedly incredible time to be Jewish. If we just look at what our ancestors, and I'm not even talking thousands of years ago, I'm talking like 200, 300 years ago, went through. At the same time, with unprecedented benefits, we have unprecedented challenges. And I can only hope that we rise up to these challenges.
Yeah, yeah, mamash. So, you know, are there any kind of practices or mindsets or things that you think that is essential for Jewish people to be doing now? I know you said we should dedicate 10%. I love that. That's like, you know, like it's almost like tzedakah, like give yeah. tzedakah of your mind, you know, and your efforts, you know, to build, like, is there stuff that y'all do on the Here I Am podcast where, you know, you kind of ask like tips, tricks, kind of daily things, mantras, things like that.
Yeah, so the first thing that I ask when I have guests on my podcast who are Jewish, because I also have non-Jewish guests, but when I have Jewish guests, the first question is, what kind of a Jew are you? And I'm surprised by how often people have never given that thought, you know, very smart, very inspiring Jewish thinkers. And I like that, because the question is not, are you a Jew, or who determines whether you're a Jew? But the assumption is, you're Jewish, now you get to determine what kind of a Jew. So I guess the first thing is, you need to know what your entry point to this experience adventure is, right? And some people say they go through the religious route or the belief route. Other people go from the more ethnic route or the cultural route or the activism route. But the one thing that I find that everybody mentions or alludes to is community. That their Jewish existence, their Jewish experience is only in relation to their communal Jewish experience. And I think that's an important thing that is sometimes difficult for Americans, and especially non-Jewish Americans, to understand, because the US is such a hyper-individualistic society. You and you alone define everything about yourself, your future, and also your past. Whereas the Jewish experience says, yes, the individual has a lot of importance, but the individual lives in a family and a community. And without the community, the individual can't fulfill themselves fully. So if you're a religious person, and there are certain prayers you cannot say without a minyan, at least a quorum of at least 10 Jewish adults, right? What does that mean? That means that you cannot fulfill your entirety of Jewish experience without a community. Same things for the chagim. You got like the ushpizin. You got different things where you have to live it with other people. So I think that's the biggest trick. And it's not a concrete so much, but really it's, you have to find your Jewish community. Now, that Jewish community can be in a religious one, like in a synagogue. It can be a cultural one, like in a Jewish community center. It could be a student one, like in school. It doesn't have to be focused on Jewish activities, but the community needs to be Jewish. It should also be open to non-Jews, right? Just like, you know, there's no exclusion going on, but the community itself needs to have some Jewish identity to it. And I tell people, find that. Find your Jewish community. It's so much easier fighting the hate when you're not alone. And it's so much more fun enjoying the small victories when you've reaped them together with someone else.
Oh, those are great to put in our pocket. I want to ask you here about being a dad and about being a Jewish dad. I'm a Jewish dad, and I ask incredible questions every day about what I should be sharing with my kids. I have a 17-year-old and a 13-year-old. I think your kids are a little younger, yeah?
Yeah, 10-year-old and a 4.5-year-old.
Thank God. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Has how you talk to them about being Jewish or anything else changed in this time that you've kind of noticed and said with your wife, like, hey, we should be more thoughtful about this, or how's that looking like?
Yeah. So the first thing I tell every parent is, your kids don't listen to you, but they do look at you. So it's not so much what you tell them as what they see you act, do, behave, say to other people, etc. So I started wearing a Star of David, my Magen David, every day. Just that's something that I do every day, weekday, weekends, every day. Just the first thing I do in the morning, I put it on. After a while, my son wanted to start wearing one. I didn't tell him you should wear a Star of David. I didn't tell him you should be proud of being Jewish. I didn't tell him you should be openly Jewish. I was just doing so myself. My wife was doing so herself, and all of a sudden he wanted one. We do a Shabbat dinner, and you know, and the kids know this is like, it's a must. Like if they have a thing, they can leave, but we're not gonna leave with them because the household is Jewish. So we do the Kiddush. I never explained why it's important to do the kiddush and something like that. I started by just doing it. After a while, when we were doing it, I started putting more meaning into it, explaining, you know, about my grandfather and how he used to do it, explaining why other Jews do it around the world, explaining different stories. But that was after we started doing things. So a lot of parents will tell me, you know, I'm really frustrated. My kids are not, you know, they're not speaking up on campus. They are not doing this. They're not doing that. And I just ask the parents, are you? Like, are you doing those things? Are you walking around introducing yourself to your colleagues as a Zionist? Because if not, then why would you expect your kids to do so? Mm-hmm. I know this is, it's sometimes it's like a little bit of a trite advice, right? Like, you know, your kids will follow your actions more than your words, but it happens to be true. The other thing I tell people, parents, is as your kids get older, your influence on them decreases and their peer group increases. So your ability to affect their life goes from direct to indirect. Well, when they were young, you can directly affect their life. When they're older, you indirectly affect their life through their peer group. So if you surround your kids with the peer group that you would want them to be like, they are more likely to turn up like that peer group. But if you don't give them that scaffolding, that infrastructure, then you don't know what peer group your kids will be like, will choose, and then what they'll end up being like.
Fantastic. I'm over here taking notes. This is awesome.
Tell me if it works. Yeah, you know, 17-year-old is very different than a 10-year-old, I must tell you.
Yes, indeed. It's been interesting to go through this with them. You know, they ask very different questions. That's really sound. You know, I think giving them space and also modeling is really important. You know, and also sharing your own things. You know, I've shared with my kids, like, I'm terrified when I have to have these conversations with people who I thought I knew and trusted and cared for and, you know, worked with and supported, to find out that their, you know, their thoughts about Jews and Jewish people are completely opposite than what I had originally suspected. But Shai, this has been amazing. Appreciate you letting me take you to these different places and relive memories that maybe aren't fun, and to have you just share these insights. And I would go out on a limb and say they're pretty wise, my friend. I know you haven't reached an age yet where maybe you're willing to accept that.
I don't know, but really, I tell people, whatever works, you got to find the way that works, but not whatever works in the hyper individualistic, whatever works for you, right? Because if I did whatever works just for me, I would probably be on a beach somewhere, disconnected from social media, disconnected from history and the present and the future. But you got to think about whatever works for the values you want to put out there in the world. And, you know, you just try. If you come into this with love and with fact-based reason, logic, you can't go wrong. The moment you start coming into this with anger or hatred or resentment, or, you know, focusing on the less factual stuff, that's when things start breaking apart. So just come towards this with positivity. Both the fight against anti-Semitism and, more importantly, the fight for Jewish continuity, I think we'll be okay if we all do that.
Amen. Amen. All right, I got to get that on a t-shirt. Or anything that you're working on right now that you'd like to share with the community, or anything you want to promote?
Wow, I got a lot. Yeah. So first of all, you mentioned my podcast, Here I Am with Shai Davidai. It's a weekly podcast, and we're always looking for more, both people to host, but also audiences, different audiences. I have a book coming out on October 6, 2026, called American Intellectual Antisemitism, which really is a historical, psychological, and sociological foray into everything that's happening on campuses. I'm working on a new project now. It's a weekly, very, very short podcast called Pragmatic Judaism, which is basically just ideas about Judaism that works. How do we keep Jewish continuity alive, irrespective of whether we do or don't believe in God, irrespective of whether we do or don't believe that the Torah was written by God or by very, very wise ancestors. How do we make the most of Jewish life for people like me and everyone else? So keep an eye out. It should be out in about a couple of months.
Fantastic. Well, looking forward to that. Those podcast episodes will be epic and people will be taking notes. I know I will be. I'm always looking for ideas, right? And it sounds like you are too.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Really, I mean, and by the way, when I talk about activism, when I talk about getting involved, like a podcast, like I'm not saying everyone should go and, you know, tie themselves to a nuclear plant and say, like, you know, Greenpeace now. Like you have a podcast, you are amplifying other people's voices, you're getting other people thinking about this. That's a sort of activism. That's, you're being active rather than passive. So, and I'm not saying everyone should now start their podcast, but find the thing that you can do to get other people active. That's what you can do to make things better for all of us.
Fabulous. Well, Shai, we appreciate you having the chutzpah to get on the news, to stand up for your students, to stand up for Jewish life on your campus, and to have the vision like you do now to walk forward. So, you know, Bezrat Hashem, hope we get to collaborate and do some fun things in the future.
Toda rabah. I hope so.